thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 39 for the 10th of March, 2009. Upgrades in the Downturn. I'm Dan Cohen. Welcome again to the Digital Campus Podcast. Podcasting this week from, our economic hovel, from the economic crater. Apocalypse, the crater, out of which we are podcasting on the cheapest possible mics. And we're here, of course. I'm Dan Cohen, joined by our regulars, Tom Scheinfeld and Mills Kelly. Hi, guys. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. You know, I'm going to live on rice and beans for a little while, but doing okay.
Good. You're not opening up your 401k plan?
That vanished long ago.
This is all we have left is this podcast, Tom and Mills, and our audience, which our beloved audience. Send us PayPal payments, please, soon.
Yeah, any amount will be appreciated.
Right. Well, welcome to the podcast, and we're going to jump right into our news roundup, where we start each and every podcast. A lot of interesting tech stories, and we will talk about the economic apocalypse in the feature story later on, but a number of these stories that I think caught our eye over the last couple of weeks sort of relate to it in terms of cost-saving measures that a university might use and new technology and the way it might play into cash-starved campuses over the next 5 years. Before we start, though, hey, Mills, did you know that Tom and I, as of tomorrow, we're recording this on Friday, March 6th, as of March 7th, Dan Cohen, yours truly, and Tom Scheinfeld will no longer be members of the Facebook Nation. We've left Facebook.
Have you really?
Yeah. We'll have to talk about it more in the future.
Taking too much time away from Twitter, was it?
It was costing too much, actually. The monthly fee we were paying to Facebook just ended up being too much. So,
yeah.
We had to scale back. No, we'll have to discuss it on a future Facebook, but we participated in a rogue action really enabled by Twitter called Forget Facebook Friday, where a bunch of people just dumped Facebook for Twitter. So we'll have to catch you over there. Let's dive in. We'll talk about Facebook on a future podcast. But since the economic news is so dire, we'll stick with that for today. First of all, a lot of interesting movements. You know, we talked about the Kindle 2 on the last podcast, and now over the past couple of weeks, they've released the Kindle app for the iPhone. We were talking about the iPhone as a potential competitor. Does this just make the eBooks platform that much more ubiquitous and more palatable for the student body? Mills, what do you think about that?
You guys will have to say what the resolution looks like on your screen I don't know if Tom has an iPhone or not, but I don't. So I haven't seen the resolution. But, I mean, my view is that students are going to prefer this kind of app rather than a Kindle because, you know, the iPhone has all this capability that a Kindle as just a book reader doesn't. And so, you know, I've been saying all along, that's the issue, is that it's not an internet device other than just a download books from the internet device. So I think students are definitely going to prefer this.
Yeah, I think this is a brilliant move on Amazon's part. I mean, my suspicion of this whole ebook thing, going back to last week's or our last show, it was that why is Amazon building hardware? And this way, it seems like they're going to build the hardware. You can get their eBooks that way, but they're providing another channel for these eBooks. I think one of the things that, at least as far as I from friends who have used the new Kindle app, as far as I know, you can't download the books yet directly to your iPod, you have to, or your iPhone, you have to put them on you know, when you sync up your iPhone. But once they build that in, and I don't know, maybe Apple won't let them, but you know, if they could build that in, then I think they've sort of got the entire landscape covered, and then I think, you know, they really could end up being kind of a monopoly with ebooks.
You know, I'm not sure about the entire landscape though for campuses in terms of at least this iPhone piece of it. And I do think that obviously the iPhone or really the iPod Touch are going to be way more popular than this dedicated Kindle device, at least among students. But it doesn't seem like you can send PDFs to your iPhone. Well, I guess you can right now, but you know they don't display that well. And I guess one of the advantages of the Kindle is you can send it a Word document or a PDF. You can email it to yourself or download it over USB. And it seems to me that for course reading, not only do you want the books, but you want that capability, don't you? I mean, isn't that a huge gap if you have a device like an iPhone or an iPod Touch or any other mobile device, if you want to have a dedicated reading device? I mean, reading a PDF on something as small as the iPhone just doesn't work.
Yeah, it is. That is true. And I think actually that's where things like netbooks come in, and I think I think that we're going to see a lot of kind of churn in this ebook space as kind of the right device for the right use shakes out. I think and I think it may be that we end up with multiple devices for multiple uses, that textbooks are better on let's say the dedicated device, and you know, newspapers and magazines and other things are better on the iPhone. I think we'll see.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think Tom's earlier point is kind of the crucial one, and that is that Amazon can't be in a position of restricting the possible sales of content to these other kinds of devices. I think, you know, they're in business to make money, and the publishers are in business to make money. And so they can't say, oh, well, the only way to distribute this is on our dedicated device.
Right. Right. You know, what I don't get is the other thing, interesting thing ebook wise that's happening on the iPhone is that people are creating ebooks just as apps and selling it through the App Store. And in fact, there was a piece on the O'Reilly Radar that these kinds of ebook iPhone applications are actually the fastest growing segment of the iPhone App Store. So, and in that way, you can think about it as if you're an author and you put a book up there, or you're a publisher and you put a book up there, you're getting 70% of the App Store price. Now, of course, that price might be pretty low, but you're not splitting it with Amazon, and you're kind of more in control of your content, aren't you? Well, maybe you're not. You're in Steve Jobs' world rather than Jeff Bezos' world. But it seems like that's another kind of alternative distribution stream is just the App Store itself.
Yeah, it just seems I think in the end, we're going to see one of the problems with these things is going to be discoverability. That, like, where is it easier for people to find your content? Is it going to be easier for them to find it through the iTunes or the iTunes Music Store interface, the App Store interface, or is it going to be easier to find it via Amazon? Seems to me that Amazon is really good at connecting people to the books they want to read. And so that might favor Amazon. On the other hand, you're right. It's like, why the intermediary? Why not just get it directly from the App Store if you're already there? In the way that you get music from the iTunes Store. So I think we're going to end up seeing some kind of a head-to-head contest between Amazon and iTunes, and maybe a three-way contest with Google jumping into the mix too.
Right. Well, another, speaking of iPhone apps, another story that we saw over the past couple of weeks was Duke University becomes yet another university. Actually, it's not the first, but it got a lot of press to unveil an application suite for the iPhone. Really a comprehensive, and of course this works on an iPod Touch as well, a whole suite that lets you know what's going on campus, includes a campus map. I think there's some location-based services. There's the whole university course catalog. I got to believe that there's going to be a lot of universities with this come fall 2009.
I think definitely. Oh. I mean, even just the campus map would be hugely useful. I mean, it's the kind of thing that it may be as useful to visitors as it is to as it is to students. I can imagine, you know, I can imagine if you're on a college tour with your high school junior, having a set of these apps that you could download and have campus maps for all the different places you're headed would be really, really useful. I also noticed that they're Duke, I think, unlike Stanford, who's done it before, are going to build this out to be useful, to be used interoperable with Blackberries as well, or at least the new multi-touch Blackberry, and you know, hopefully for me, the Android phone.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you can imagine right away, just on the campus map piece, then from the standpoint of, you know, people, visitors coming to the campus, when you're in a particular location, touching on the image of a building and then seeing what the lab looks like inside, or watching 5 minutes of a lecture in one of the lecture halls inside, just that alone, I think, would be a great marketing tool for universities. So I think they'll definitely jump on – I think admissions offices will jump on that as a possible application.
Yeah, I got to believe it's great marketing to have like that little D, you know, or the big D in the – for the Duke logo sitting in the App Store. It looks contemporary. Yeah. It looks future.
I just don't know about the one thing that I wonder about this, and I think you're right that like we're going to see a lot of this in fall of 2009. But one thing I don't quite understand is like it seems like are like all 3,500 colleges and universities in America going to build their own app, and we're going to have, you know, like in the App Store, there's going to be 3,500 different universities with their own. I mean, and they're all like essentially doing the same thing and recreating the wheel. It seems like somebody should be building some kind of a platform for doing this rather than, you know, each university building its own specific iPhone app that basically does the same thing.
Right. Well, it seems like Stanford students who created a mobile application suite for Stanford in the fall. I can't remember if it was part of that course at Stanford on creating iPhone apps, they created a company called Terribly Clever Design to make Duke Mobile and the Stanford thing. It seems like they just would have a template that you could.
Oh, so they're going to provide. I see.
Yeah, so you
can
contract to them. But I mean, this does get to the point of for campus use and even. Just what we were talking about with book releases as apps, doesn't the App Store get so cluttered with, you know, what will eventually be, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of books and thousands of university applications? And it still makes you yearn for the more open platform of Android, where you could just go to, in our case, let's say gmu.edu, and just download the app straight from there rather than fishing around for it at the Apple App Store. Kind of doesn't make sense as a long-term discoverability model.
Yeah, I think we're really going to run into that with the App Store, and it's this closed model, and I think that's one of the problems with it.
Well, iTunes University getting more good press in New Scientist had a article really looking at the way in which iTunes U has been used on campuses and. Particularly the podcast lectures that Mills, you've really been pushing for many years now. And they did an actual study. It seemed like an actual scientific study, according to the New Scientist, a randomized study where half of a class got a downloaded podcast and half did not. And, you know, in other words, they attended the class in person. Can you believe it? And looked at this, and they really thought that the students who downloaded the podcast you know, ended up getting better test scores than those who attended the physical lecture. Mills, confirmed? Are you finally verified scientifically what you've been saying for years?
God, it's so nice to have an I told you so moment, you know? I get so few.
Right.
But, you know, this is, I mean, first of all, it shows that lecturing is not a very good form of teaching. Being in the physical presence of the lecturer is actually worse for you than having a recording of the lecturer in terms of your performance on exams, then what does that tell us about lecturing? and so, I mean, you know, I would love for our listeners, somebody to please send me an article they could find somewhere that demonstrates in a scientific way that lecturing is actually an effective form of teaching. But because I've been looking for such an article for years and haven't found one, but maybe it's out there. But what it does show is that if the delivery model, if the information delivery model is just a push model, then, you know, somebody standing up on a stage and pushing information at students, then it's actually better to record it and have them have it on, you know, on a podcast, because as this article shows, the study in the article shows, you know, the parts they didn't get, they can immediately back up and watch it again, listen to it again, and replay it several times until they get it. And so their performance on exams was much better. I saw somebody give a presentation along these lines about 3 years ago at a conference. He was an engineering professor from somewhere in New Zealand, and they did a similar kind of test where they had, you know, the same class taught by the same person. One version of the class was podcast and the other version of the class was not. Civil Engineering 101 or whatever it was. And the students in the podcasted version of the class did substantially better on their exams than the students in the non-podcasted version. But the thing that was really interesting about his presentation was that they looked at the download statistics on the podcasts, and what they found was that the vast majority, I don't know, it was like 70%, something like that, of the podcasts were downloaded within, say, 72 hours of the exam. And so the students just downloaded the whole suite of the, you know, 6 weeks worth of lectures and listened to them all one after another and then sat for the exam and did really well. And he said that in their department, they had kind of two reactions to that finding. One of them was that a group of faculty members were just horrified and said, God, what is wrong with our teaching that our students can just download our lectures, listen to them all in 48 hours or so before the exam and actually do better on the exams. We must be doing something really wrong in the classroom. The other half of the department said, wow, this is fabulous. You know, I can just go into a studio, record all my lectures for the entire semester in, say, a day, 2 days, and then I've done my teaching for the whole semester. I'm done. I can go do my research. And so he said,
"Let's work a few days a year. This is genius.
That's right.
Yes,
that's right. So it's and you know, this New Scientist story seems to indicate that group was right.
Well, and you don't just have to do it. It's not just a couple of days a year. It's a couple of days in your career, right? So you could, because you just record the lectures for, you know, you teach a, let's say, a suite of over the course of your career, 10 or 12 different classes, you could just do them all in a span of a couple of weeks and just be done with it.
Okay, Tom, I have to stop you there. I don't want you to ever say that out loud again, because there's somebody listening to our podcast right now who is in the business side of the university, and teaching is work made for hire. And so the university is going to, his university is going to say, oh, wow, we just get them to record all of their lectures once, and then we can dispense with the faculty member because we've got all of his lectures, and the students will do just fine.
Well, right. See, I mean, that's what I was sort of getting at, is like, the, if you take this argument to its logical extreme, what do you end up with? I mean, you end up with those recorded lectures that you can, you know, buy in the backs of magazines and stuff. It's something I think we're going to need to work out. And I think it does speak to something that's might be wrong with the teaching model that we've followed and that we need to. I think there needs to be done on this topic, because I think it does say something about the way students are taught on our campuses these days.
Yeah. Well, with that, maybe that's a good segue into our featured story about reducing costs on campus. Oh gosh, I hope we don't end up the featured story saying that we'll fire all the professors. But let's move on and see what we have to say about that topic. Well, as we all unfortunately know by this point, the Dow is way, way down, 60% as we speak from its all-time high. And down also are campus endowments, off in many cases 20, 30, 40%. And state budgets are down, of course, and in crisis, hurting universities like our own beloved George Mason University. And we did want to pause on a serious note on this podcast and think about what this really means, and particularly how it might affect the use or the avoidance, I guess, of technology, since technology can be expensive as well as money saving, and see what it really means for the next 3 to 5 years on campuses. What will take place because of this downturn, what it'll mean for technology and library and museum budgets are also feeling the crunch. And of course, that's part of our topic of discussion here as well. So we're going to just kick right in and start talking about this. You know, starting with where we left off in the news roundup, I guess the question is, are there ways that technology can really save money by, let's say, making better use of iTunes U and reducing the need for expensive physical plant like classrooms? Mills, I mean, we were sort of joshing about this, but is one potential outcome, let's say, the use of kind of more canned teaching, a kind of, you know, invasion of distance education into the mainstream of education practice? And after all, it is really expensive to have people show up on campus with, I was going to say expensive professors. We're not that expensive, but we're more expensive than a podcast. Is this a potential outcome? And where do you see things going in the next 3 to 5 years in terms of cost savings and how technology might affect that course?
Well, first of all, I hope 5 years from now I can be classified as an expensive professor, but it's one of my career goals. I want to be expensive. But, right. You know, here's a specific example of how the iTunes U stuff we were talking about in the news roundup can really make a difference. As George Mason began slashing its budgets back in the fall in response to the state's economic crisis. Of course, for us, we have virtually no endowment, so we weren't affected by the stock market plunge in that way. It's just the state has no money, so we had to start slashing our budgets. And so for this coming fall, every department in our college and the university had to make do with less money and increase the class sizes on average by 6%. So, you know, some classes didn't increase at all and others increased by 15%, but we had to average a 6% increase. The problem is you bump up against a physical limit. You know, a lot of our classrooms on campus only seat 45. So how you can, and if the class already enrolls 45, you can't add another 7 or 8 students into that class to get that 6% increase. And so some kind of hybrid model where the class could either be taken physically or virtually makes it possible to take a popular course and then have lots of students take advantage of that course. So, for instance, we have one person who teaches in our Western Civ freshman course, who his waiting list, he's so popular that his waiting list consistently have, you know, 100, 150 students on them for 50 student classes. And so students just line up to try to get into his classes. Well, if his lectures were all podcast, then he could be in the classroom for those 50 students, and the other 100 or 150, instead of sitting on a waiting list, could just download the podcast. And they could all be registered for the course, and they could all be paying tuition, and it would save the university a tremendous amount of money. So I think we're going to see universities, especially because, you know, space is finite on our campuses, really grapple with this and see, are there ways that we can construct hybrid course models that blend traditional teaching methods with technology-enhanced teaching, and if only to save money. But, you know, this story that we talked about in the news roundup seems to indicate that there might be a pedagogical value also.
But, Mills, I mean, isn't the – I'm sure our audience is wondering about this. I mean, isn't the – potential outcome a kind of smaller group of, you know, professors or tenure track professors just teaching more people? I mean, isn't this a kind of way to effectively get cheap labor and some would say sort of cheapen the classroom experience? So what would you say to those people who are just saying, well, okay, now Mills can teach 1,000 people a year rather than 100 people a year?
Yeah, the labor issue is definitely one to be considered. For me, I'm a lot less interested in the labor issue and a lot more interested in the learning issue. What I want to see is the learning outcomes from any particular kind of teaching. So, you know, a small class with a world-renowned researcher, where the world-renowned researcher stands in front of the students and reads his lecture notes that he's been giving for the last 15 years, that class might as well have nobody in it, because there's probably very little actual learning going on in that room. Where it's possible that some kind of virtual class or mixed virtual and analog class, a tremendous amount of learning is occurring. So I think the real question is not who how many students are in the classroom, but what kind of learning is actually happening. And, you know, as I was joking in the news roundup about, the, you know, iTunes U courses showing more learning in whatever class that was, I'm kind of on the side of there was something wrong with the way that class was being taught. And that's why just listening to a podcast would cause it, students to do better on an exam. So I think the real question is, how are we teaching and how are the students learning? And then what's the optimal model to and the model is different in every discipline to try to maximize learning, because that's the point, is maximizing learning. You know, universities have to at least break even, but the real point is maximizing learning.
Tom, what are your thoughts? How do you think there are ways that universities and libraries and museums can take advantage of technology to reduce costs, even if it perhaps requires some investment in cyber infrastructure or technical equipment upfront?
Well, I mean, I think we have talked about sort of outsourcing some of the infrastructure, some of the email and services, licensing agreements that they have, moving to open source software, moving to web services instead of desktop applications and those kinds of things. So I think there's an opportunity there. I think, like, from my particular position in the university, you know, managing a largely grant funded institution, I'm sort of interested to see where the financial crunch, how it affects grant making and grant getting. I know, like, it. I think we are all excited to see that the funding for in the president's budget that he sent up to the Hill, funding for NEH and NEA and NSF and NHPRC and all of the funding agencies that we go to, all the federal agencies that we go to for money, those budgets have all been increased modestly in the president's budget, which is a good thing, and I think we're all very pleased with that. But I do think that in this economic downturn, we're going to be seeing a lot more competition for that money. And I think, and maybe this is wishful thinking on my part, but I do think that digital projects that can show a lot of bang for the buck, where they're reaching large audiences, where they're doing truly innovative work, are going to be better positioned to get that money in this new competitive environment than maybe more traditional projects. That may or may not be a good thing, depending on whether you're a tech enthusiast or not. But I do think that's one opportunity. But I think we're going to see a lot more competition for these grants in the next year or two.
Yeah, and it seems to me, flowing out of that on the beyond the research side of things and the grant side of things, on the undergraduate side of things, we're starting up an undergrad course in digital history next year. I think all three of us and probably a lot of our audience read the article either online or in the physical newspaper in the New York Times about the humanities sort of justifying themselves and their worth during this economic downturn, that, you know, there are fewer history majors and humanities majors than there were 30 years ago, a lot fewer. And, there's a sort of feeling, I guess, among some that the humanities have to justify themselves. Now, of course, that we won't get into the argument about whether that's valid. Obviously the abstractions of humanities and learning about human nature and culture and worth sort of has its own value beyond money. But it does seem to me that having a technology angle to something like a history major or a art major, let's say in digital, who understands how to use Photoshop extremely well, or any other major that sort of takes advantage of digital technology, it at least gives those undergraduates another possible outlet for employment after graduation. If they don't end up getting a job in history per se, they have some technical skills that would transfer well into the current job market. As bad as it is, it's probably better to have some technical experience as part of that undergrad degree. If you really are interested in humanities, you can get some of that by getting involved in digital humanities. And at least in that way, it strikes me that digital humanities right now is in a very good position to kind of show its value by kind of communicating some really practical technical skills in addition to the, you know, the historical rigor and the humanities rigor that we also love.
I think that's absolutely right. There was another article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, probably now, that saying that one of the few sectors of the job market that's growing is digital archivists. In fact, and you know that there's jobs in digital imaging and digital archiving, not just at institutions, libraries, and museums and archives, but in industry, in business, those kinds of skills are things that we really can teach. We know about those things, those are transferable skills. So I hope that that's something we're going to see too. We're seeing it at George Mason, and I think we'll probably start seeing more and more of it elsewhere.
The other thing is just what we've been talking about in the podcast now for the last couple of years is that there are all of these, you know, free services like Google Docs or, you know, free email or, you know, all these other ways that technology is now essentially free. I mean, it's not entirely free because the university has to, if they go with, you know, say Gmail, they still have to have a few people on campus who are the Gmail support people for all of those faculty members who can't figure out how to manage their mailboxes. But by and large, it's going to be a lot cheaper than any sort of enterprise application that the universities are using. And so I think we're going to see a lot of pressure on the purchasing side of the university when it comes to rethinking those contractual relationships with various enterprise applications. I think we're just going to – I think the stuff we've been talking about for the last couple of years is going to really accelerate in the next year because the money's just not there.
Mills, this was your – I have to give kudos to you for your prediction for 2009 was, in fact, free. That free was going to take over. And I think you in part said that we were already in the downturn, but, in part you just saw it as a general trend on the web toward free applications. And Chris Anderson, the editor of Wired, is coming out with a book called Free, and all about free things and how they're kind of taking over our economy in a digital age. But now it's even kind of more pressing, isn't it? I mean, these transitions to things like outsourcing to, let's say, Gmail or Hotmail or, some of these big kind of technical infrastructure aspects that have been at universities for literally two decades. I mean, email service, for instance, which was always hosted in-house. Obviously, there'll still be some problems with, local laws and privacy laws in terms of the things that universities have to do to keep track of their own electronic records. But for a lot of things, they can get outsourced, right? And you're not going to end up wanting to pay $1 million a year to Microsoft or Oracle for licenses when you can get, pretty much the equivalent for free. That's going to be a really compelling sale, I guess, if you can call it that at this point.
Yeah, and, going back to what we were saying a minute ago on podcasting, you can – so I've been podcasting one of my undergraduate classes the last two times I've taught it now. And so if you're a George Mason student, you can access those podcasts through our iTunes U site. Or if you're not a George Mason student, you can just access them through iTunes because I put them in both places. And so you can listen to my lectures for free by accessing them through iTunes, or you can also, if you're a George Mason student, you can listen to them for free, but you can't get credit for my class unless you pay tuition. And so that's one of the examples of, how the free economy is going to start shaping what higher education does, I think, is that an awful lot of people are going to start, especially, we work for the state of Virginia, and so I'm a public employee, and so I ought to be making my stuff free to the public. They can't get credit unless they pay for the credit, but they should have access to whatever it is that I have to say about a subject because they're paying my salary.
And I think we may see at a place like George Mason, maybe not in the state of Virginia, but state governments looking at all kinds of ways to cut their budgets. I wouldn't be surprised to see some state governments, as we've seen some other national governments from around the world, move to favor open source software as they move forward with purchasing. I saw that the UK government just, I guess, last week changed its stance towards open source software. It used to have kind of a neutral stance that, you know, you could go either way. Now they've got now the stance is that they favor where, all things considered, you know, the open source software does the job as well. They are mandating the use of open source software in government agencies. That's going to trickle down to universities, which most of which in the UK are government entities, and I think that's going to happen with state governments in the states, where we see them some starting to move to open source software just as a place for cost savings, and so we may see that trickle down to our campuses as well.
And cloud computing as well seems to get a huge advantage here because so many cloud services are also free, right? I mean, doesn't Tom, you just got a netbook recently. I mean, this seems like a boon for netbooks. It's in the same way that the one retail store that's doing incredibly well right now is Walmart in the United States. Its sales are actually up because people are looking for the least expensive option for their basics, and they're keeping it to the basics. And it seems like the netbook phenomenon is sort of perfectly matched for an economic apocalypse, isn't it? I mean, especially once you move over to, let's say, a Gmail or some other kind of cloud provider, or Google Docs or Zoho Office, you just need a cheap laptop or machine that just has access to the web. You don't need a lot of RAM or storage or a really fast video card. Everything just lives on the cloud.
Yeah, I have over the course of the past few years, sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally, ended up migrating most of my data over to web services, and I got this netbook, and really, I frankly don't see any reason to have my expensive laptop anymore. I mean, this thing, which was $300 or so, does everything I needed to do. All my data is there. It doesn't have a ton of local storage, but I don't need a ton of local storage. It has a VGA port. It has USB ports. I can put an external monitor on it. I can put a keyboard and a mouse on it. It has Bluetooth. That's pretty much all I need. Now, if I want to do some heavy-duty video editing or something, this is not the box to do that on. But for, you know, 95% of my computing needs, this netbook is fine. And I think we're going to see a lot of that. I think it's really going to hurt, and I think computer manufacturers are already seeing this, that why would you buy the $1,500 or the $2,500 laptop if you could buy the $300 laptop and it does everything or almost everything you need it to do and everything the other box does? And I think that's the reason why we haven't seen one from Apple, is why would any business want to cut their profit margins by, you know, half or more, by putting out a new device that's so much cheaper. So I think we will see more netbooks on campus in this downturn.
And it's time for our picks of the episode, special money saving edition this week. Apropos to our featured story, we've selected applications, links, other things we've seen that can reduce your costs and give you some value at the same time. Tom, what do you have for us this episode?
I've got something from Google called TipJar. It uses their moderator web service, which is a web service to help you organize group discussions and conference discussions and other things. But they've used that technology to build something called TipJar. We'll post the link in the show notes. It's a little bit of a ponderous link, but it's a place where you can go and you can suggest money saving tips, and other people can vote on those, and the most popular ones will rise to the top, kind of crowdsourcing money saving tips. And it has different sections: tips to save money in finance, in health, in shopping, in food, in vacations. It has a tech section where the right now the number one tip, as voted by the by the users is turn off your computer at night. Other tips that they have are call your cable company to cancel your service, and they'll generally, if you do that, offer you a discount. So if you want to go find a bunch of money-saving tips, TipJar is one place to look.
Great. Google TipJar. And, of course, we'll link to this from digitalcampus.tv. Mills, how about you? What did you find online this week?
Well, mine is also a money saver, and it's GOI.com. There, it's a company that does high-resolution satellite imagery, but they have a really nice gallery of satellite images, incredibly high-resolution satellite images. It'd be really useful for teaching images of places like, you know, Angkor Wat and the pyramids at Giza. And so, you know, so people, especially people teaching world history, just really, really fabulous images. And amazingly, you can download the images and republish them as long as you give them proper attribution. So it's a nice, it's a nice free teaching resource for people who want to, you know, jazz up a lecture, jazz up a website. So it's another good money saver.
Terrific. And these are really high quality images I can see. Wow. Well, I have another Google pick similar to Tom's, actually a whole suite, and it's the Google Apps for Your Domain. It's a little bit of a prosaic name for it. But if you do have your own domain, and I've had dancohen.org for over, I guess, about around a decade now, I've just sort of installed Google Apps for my domain. And what it lets you do is, if you're used to using Gmail, it gives you your own Gmail, dan@dancohen.org email address, but it pipes it through Gmail, and you get all of the Google Docs and all the other free Google Apps that you can log into, and it gives you an administrator interface. So if you have other people you want to add to your domain, you can give them their own Gmail account, manage all of this from the web. It's really nice basic suite. I guess the only drawback is that you can't get certain things that I'm used to from the consumer account. So, Tom, I think you noticed this as well. They don't have the newsreader, Google Reader, which is what I use to read blogs. For some reason, that's not part of Google Apps for Your Domain. I think it's because it's really more oriented toward businesses. So,
They focus on things like
calendars. Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
Right, but I was surprised. So Reader is kind of more of a consumer product, but there are other things that aren't built into it. Analytics, which you'd think that businesses would be really interested in, and Google Groups, which is something that I would think businesses would be interested in too. Maybe it's just that they haven't rolled them into the service yet.
I should say they do, because this is really, I think, again, oriented toward businesses. And indeed, there's a paid version that's really only $50 a year, but that guarantees you uptime and things like that. I think because of that, it seems to me they're hinting that they don't want to roll anything into Google Apps for Your Domain unless it's really rock solid and that it's very business oriented and can be trusted. And so they tend not to do some of the fancier parts of, for instance, Gmail. You can't quite get you do get Gmail Labs, but you can't skin Gmail as much as you can in the consumer apps. There's kind of pieces of it that, again, I think they're trying to keep really basic so that if you had a non-technical administrator, they could manage the entire domain, manage your own website, etc., without bumping into some of the more distracting and complex elements that you get through, you know, all the Google beta applications. And it seems that they're all in beta. So they try not to have too much clutter, I think, when you do get Google Apps for your domain. Well, we have come to the end of another episode, and we want to thank everyone for listening in. We hope you're doing okay and that your savings are still there. And, you know, we are a free podcast, so do tune in again next time for the great cost of $0. And of course, subscribe to us via iTunes. I think we spoke about iTunes U, but I think as of this episode, we'll be available in iTunes U as well. So look for us there or look for us online at digitalcampus.tv.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. or you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.